I want to begin by referring to an American novelist whose works have been quite a bit discussed in the last couple of years, and who not so long ago actually published a very interesting little book on science and religion, a book called Absence of Mind. Her name is Marilyn Robinson. Some of you may have come across her. She's only written three novels, and the last two, which are called Gilead and Home, are novels about a little community in the Midwest of America in about 1956. They're very unusual novels. They're very slow-paced. They build up a vivid, detailed, patient picture of what in some ways sounds like an amazingly boring environment. And they're novels, just to make sure you're absolutely gripped, they're novels about the families of clergymen. So, you know, on the face of it, they're not going to get into the station bookstores. And yet these novels have had a really extraordinary impact on lots of readers, here and in the States. And the phrase that struck me and that I want to focus on at the beginning of my remarks is a phrase used by another novelist, a British novelist, who writes novels of a kind completely different from Marilyn Robinson. Novels about football. I can't imagine what Marilyn Robinson would make of football. But he remarked of her novels that she makes you see why Christianity might be something you could use to think with. She makes you see why Christianity might be something you could use to think with. Behind that remark, of course, lies the assumption that a lot of people make, which is that religion is something quite divorced from thinking. I suspect that the two presentations we've already had this afternoon will have disabused you of that to some degree. But let's focus a little bit on just why our British novelist was so unexpectedly impressed by Marilyn Robinson. In what she says about her own books, she speaks of trying to write about grace and forgiveness. She's writing, as I said, about the families of two elderly clergymen in this little Midwestern town. The son of one of them left the town in disgrace many years before, and he's returned. What's going to happen to him? Is he going to be forgiven and welcomed? And what does it mean for his father and his sister to forgive him? Initially, of course, he comes back saying he's sorry he went away, and it's the prodigal son from the Bible all over again. But, says Marilyn Robinson in one of her interviews, I always used to ask myself, what happened the morning after the prodigal son came home? When the stray, sinful brother goes away, what really happens when he comes back? Yes, you say, I forgive you. Yes, you say, I welcome you. And then what? What's it like to live forgiveness and grace at a level of more than just making the right noises about it? So really, these are novels about how difficult it is to forgive, how difficult it is to understand in human relationships this dimension that we call grace, the unexpected welcome that changes things for you. Now, I begin with Marilyn Robinson's novels and that remark about them, because it seems to me that what they're saying is that if you want a three-dimensional account of what it's like to be a human being, you may find yourself, sooner or later, reaching for language that has religious roots or religious echoes. You can't talk about forgiveness for very long without somehow at least coming close to the frontiers of religious language, because the language of God that we're familiar with is so often a language about absolute forgiveness, about mercy, about renewal. But it's not easy language, and it's not an easy set of experiences. It needs a bit of time to think through and feel through. You need stories to explore it, like these novels. That in turn suggests that if you want to educate people in what it feels like to be a human being, you may at least need to have some kind of literacy, some familiarity with some bits of what I'll call the religious palette, you know, the palette of colours that he makes from. And that's why, to my mind, religion, in the very broadest sense, I'll get a bit narrower later on, in the very broadest sense, needs to be part of what we think of as education at every level. Because it's part of trying to get a three-dimensional perspective on human experience. Leave it out, and you end up talking about cardboard persons, two-dimensional characters. As both speakers really have already illustrated far more carefully and learnedly than I could, leaving it out, leaving religion in the private box, doesn't have the effect of liberating you to think of humanity in a much more exciting and vivid way. It has the effect of washing out some of the colours, reducing some of the range. And you don't actually have to be a person believing passionately and wholeheartedly in one of the traditional religions to understand why it might be that you need those colours on the palette, or you need those keys on the piano, or whatever metaphor you want to use. Taking religion seriously in education is part of trying to achieve that three-dimensional response to humanity. That is, dealing with human beings as they are, not as you think they'd like to be. And that is exactly one of the fallacies that we have to deal with in some of the opposition to Christianity and other religions in public these days. It's the idea that somehow there's a perfectly natural and obvious default setting for the human mind, which is atheism. Unfortunately, generations and generations of rather stupid people have messed it up, complicated it, by adding in religion to the mix. In order to set people free from these terrible complications and entanglements of another kind, we cut the cord, we allow eccentric and bizarre people to practice religion in private if they really insist, and we keep our educational system and our political life clinically free and pure from all these embarrassing, difficult aspects of humanity represented by religion. And the trouble is, as I say, that we end up with something rather less than human. Many people have begun to become rather more aware of this in the last decade or two, as it's been recognised that religion has not, so to speak, curled up and died quietly as it was meant to do. You can still read people writing in the 50s and 60s, as a lad, about how religion was manifestly doomed as an irrational, residual bit of primitive mentality. And all you can really say a few decades on is that if it's irrational and residual, the roots must go pretty deep, because it's not showing very many signs of dying across the world, whatever it may or may not be doing in the prosperous West. So at the very least, if you want something approaching a global understanding of what human experience is like, your education ought to be sensitizing to that dimension represented by religious commitment and practice. But it's not only about the global perspective. It's also about our own understanding of ourselves and of our past. This is where we get a little bit narrower. As John's been reminding us, there's a whole lot of ideas in our regular repertoire in this country and in this culture, which, as a matter of fact, have some quite tough roots in religious discourse. And while people say perfectly correctly that you can talk about them these days without invoking religion, there remains the awkward question of how far you can actually cut them off from their roots and they still survive. in 50 or 70 or 100 years' time? Will what we now say about human rights still sound so obvious if it has been cut off for generations from its original roots in an unashamedly religious perspective on what it's like to be human? I think that's an open question, but one we really ought to be reflecting on. So both in terms of understanding what's going on across the world, and in terms of understanding where we come from, and particularly the Jewish Christian tradition that's formed our ethics in the West, in both those contexts, we need a level of competence about what it's like to be a religious human being if we want to understand fully the possibilities of being a human being. And that, I think, takes us to some quite demanding questions about what we think education is anyway. I, in my unregenerate old-fashioned way, like to think that education is about developing the imagination, developing human beings' sense of the surprisingness, the unpredictability, and the depth of what's around you. So that when I say imagination, I include maths, physics, as well as literature, or music, or indeed sport. Education is trying to open to you those dimensions that make human life resourceful, rich, three-dimensional again, or as some people like to say, thick-textured. The things that make life more than just coping, more than just surviving, more than just acquiring. Reduce education just to the level of getting the skills you need in order to pass the next set of tests, whether in school or afterwards, and something rather less than real education is, I would say, taking place. And in the best kinds of educational institution, it's pretty clear that what is in view is not just giving people a set of useful transferable skills and boxes ticked, but some sense of where young men and women can look in future life for the resources that will help them to be human. Resources which will not just be the skills they happen to have, the interest they have in this or that moment, their earning capacity, or whatever else. It's quarrying down into some of those things that genuinely give our life a sense of worth. Among those things is obviously the practice of religion. Education, in other words, ought to be, or so I believe very firmly, an induction into humanity. Into the way humanity works in this society, but also an induction into the ways humanity works in lots of different contexts. For that to be real and robust, it's got to take account of the religious. It's got to help you see why not only Christianity, but other religious faiths are material for you to think with. Back to Marilynne Robinson and novels again for a moment. I'm always intrigued by the way in which not only believing novelists, Christian novelists, and Marilynne Robinson is herself personally a very devout Christian, but those who wouldn't at all identify themselves as religious still reach for the resources of religious language in order to deal with complicated, unpromising, tough bits of experience. Many of you will know Ian McEwan's novel Atonement, or perhaps have seen the film based on it. And there's an interesting case of somebody who is himself highly skeptical about religion, reaching for a very technical theological concept, a concept right out of the heartland of religious language, to say something about offense and betrayal and restoration and what is and isn't possible in terms of putting human lives back together again when they've been wrecked through betrayal, through psychological violence. And he's not alone in reaching for that sort of language in order to make that sort of sense. All of this takes for granted that there just are bits of ourselves that are never going to fit very neatly into a calculus of winning and losing, succeeding and failing, acquiring skills, and acquiring profit. They're the bits of ourselves that tend to suffer, to rejoice, to fall in love, to have crises, to resent and hate, as well as to love and forgive. There's some very dark areas of our psyches and some very bright ones. And if you focus all your human attention on what you might call the acceptable, comfortable middle range of emotions and human experiences, then you will end up leading a very eccentric kind of human life. The strange thing about our culture, and this is actually one of the points that Marilynne Robinson makes in the book I referred to at the start, Absence of Mind, the odd thing is that we currently live in a culture where it seems to be thought a very good idea to have a narrow, middle-of-the-spectrum approach to humanity and leave out the dangerous or the difficult bits. We're not, as a culture, terribly receptive to the life of the imagination and the arts, just as we're not terribly receptive to religion or serious philosophy. And we lose out. So in terms of religion and education, I'm not trying to make a case, on this occasion anyway, for compulsory religious instruction in schools. I'm not talking about trying to persuade students of this or that set of commitments or beliefs. But I am advocating very, very strongly an educational philosophy and practice that exposes students to what I've called the three-dimensional perspective, the full range of resources available for people to make sense of who they are and what their world is like. And there is no sensible or credible way of denying that belief in God, in sin, in forgiveness, in grace, all of those things have featured pretty prominently in the ways people have made sense of the darker and more difficult, more demanding areas of human experience. So, I'm certainly looking for the study of religion to be an essential part of any educational practice worth the name. It doesn't mean that people are being corralled into believing this or that. It certainly involves, to go back to what John was saying, that attitude of respectful questioning. Why do people come to these conclusions? Why do people live like that? What's the argumentation that ends you up just there? But that respectful questioning does at least assume that outside our comfort zones as human beings, there are quite a lot of areas where we feel lost and distressed and amazed and overwhelmed, for which we're going to need some sort of language in our lives. And among the many, many functions of the language of religious belief is holding all of that for us, and holding it in context that stimulates, affirms, challenges, and gives hope. Which is why I believe that religion belongs at the very heart of any educational process worth the name. Thank you.